Good evening. My name is Penny Fletcher. I'm president and CEO for the Lupus Foundation of America, D.C., Maryland, Virginia chapter. You may be joining through our chapter or through one of six other chapters who are participating in presenting this call to you. We thank you for joining us and for participating. I am very pleased to introduce our speaker, Dr. Donald E. Thomas, Jr. Dr. Thomas has been part of our chapter in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia for many years. In addition to being a partner in a local practice, he actively teaches rheumatology at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and he has continued throughout his career to be active at the Uniformed Services University of Health Services in Bethesda, Maryland. He is an active member of the American Board of College of Physicians and the American College of Rheumatology, and he is board certified in both rheumatology and internal medicine. Dr. Thomas has received many awards in his career, and they include the AMA Physician Recognition Award from 2000 to 2006. He was recognized as one of Washington, D.C.'s top doctors for rheumatology, and he has been an active participant in our Medical Scientific Advisory Council. In addition, he is actively working on a new book that will come out on lupus. So we are eagerly looking forward to that publication. That being said, I'm going to turn this call over to Dr. Thomas, who will go through his presentation. As I mentioned, you can follow along with the PDF. And at the end, I will be coming back in to moderate a few questions right at the end of the hour. Thank you again for calling into this call. Dr. Thomas?
Thank you very much, Penny. And one thing I'd like to ask before I start, Penny, is I am interested in improving upon this talk to focus on what patients and family members would like to get out of it. So at the end, right now, can we give any information on how they could give me feedback on how we could improve the talk or the handout itself?
I think that's a great question, because I know you do this a lot, and I'm happy to see you're always seeking to improve, as we all should be. I would say they should contact their chapters, and I will alert everyone's chapter in the morning that we have asked for feedback and that they share that back to the D.C., Maryland, Virginia chapter, and we will pass it along to you. So any comments on the presentation itself or on the materials handed out would be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Penny. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'd like to say that thank you to everybody who's listening on the talk this evening. What my goal is in this presentation is to give basic information to anyone who has systemic lupus, whether you've had it for a long time or recently diagnosed. What my goal is to give educational information on what lupus is, what it can cause, and how to live with lupus and take the medications and therapies and even things that don't require medications to live a long, normal life and try to make it so you understand what it is and basically take control of it as much as you can. I've been treating lupus patients for close to 20 years, and one thing I definitely observe is people who educate themselves as much about lupus as they can really do the best in the long run as far as living a long, normal life, and that's what I would like to share with you this evening. And as Penny just mentioned, I would like to find out more from you on how we can improve upon this in the future. So first of all, what is SLE? And by the way, SLE stands for systemic lupus erythematosus, and it's a big mouthful of words to say. We say SLE for short, and anyone dealing with lupus knows what that means. But let's break down the terms to figure out what SLE means. First of all, SLE is an autoimmune disease. Auto is the Greek word for self, and immune refers to the immune system of the body. The immune system is that part of our body that usually protects us like if we get germs like strep throat or pneumonia or a urinary tract infection, or even if we get something like a cancer, something that's invading our body, the immune system is composed of the white blood cells, which sees these foreign invaders and basically attacks them to keep us healthy throughout our life. And the immune system is composed of the white blood cells in other parts of the body, such as the spleen, the lymph glands, even the tonsils and other bodies that compose white blood cells. So in people with autoimmune diseases, the immune system is overactive and it starts to attack the body itself, and therefore that's why we use the term autoimmune disease. As far as examples of autoimmune diseases, juvenile diabetes is one example where people are born with genes where the body attacks the pancreas. The pancreas then can't make insulin, and so the person gets high glucose levels and has to take insulin for the rest of their lives. Thyroid disease is another very common autoimmune disease where the immune system attacks the thyroid gland, which is located in the neck, and they have to take thyroid supplements for the rest of their life. Lupus is an example of a systemic autoimmune disease. In fact, that's where the S part of SLE comes from, is from systemic. Systemic autoimmune diseases are where the immune system can attack multiple organs or systems of the body, such as the joint, the heart, the lungs, the nerves, the kidneys. The most frequent systemic autoimmune disease, or best example and most well-known example, is rheumatoid arthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis is actually related to systemic lupus, but in rheumatoid arthritis, the immune system mainly attacks the joints, where it can cause inflammation and damage to the joints of the body. But with SLE or systemic lupus, SLE can attack any part of the body. The word lupus comes from the Latin word for wolf. In fact, since the Middle Ages, we've actually had a medical term of lupus to describe any type of disease that attacks the skin. And back in the Middle Ages, wolves in Europe were one of the biggest culprits against man, where wolves could get a hold of people and grab the skin and cause disfigurements to the skin or ulcerations. And so lupus was a term used to describe any type of rash that was disfiguring to the body. And then erythematosus refers to any type of redness of the skin. And oftentimes the rashes of lupus are reddish in color. Therefore, systemic lupus erythematosus refers to this disorder where oftentimes there's red disfiguring rashes of the skin, and so SLE. There's four different major types of lupus. First is the cutaneous lupus. Cutaneous is a medical term meaning skin, and this is where lupus affects the skin. In fact, dermatologists or skin experts see a lot more patients who only have cutaneous lupus without actually affecting the systemic or internal organs. So many people with lupus only have the cutaneous or skin type without ever developing the systemic type. Neonatal lupus refers to lupus which affects newborn babies, and this occurs in babies who are born to women who are positive for antibodies, especially an antibody called SSA antibody or one called SSB antibody. These antibodies go through the placenta, and then they can actually attack either the skin or the heart of the newborn baby. If the new neonatal or the newborn baby with neonatal lupus develops a skin rash, fortunately it goes away after about 8 months when these antibodies disappear out of the baby's system. Unfortunately, if they attack the heart, the baby could end up having to have a pacemaker because of the permanent damage to the heart from the neonatal lupus. Drug-induced lupus is not nearly as common as it used to be because the most common offending drugs, especially procainamide and hydralazine, which are used to treat blood pressure, are not used nearly as often as they used to be used. But drug-induced lupus is when systemic lupus occurs because of an offending drug, and when we take the drug away, the lupus fortunately goes completely away, which is good. And so it's a reversible type of systemic lupus. And then lastly, we have systemic lupus erythematosus, or SLE, which is the reason for our talk this evening. So what causes SLE? Just as with all autoimmune diseases, people are born with the genes that cause it. There's a lot of different genes which can cause it as well. The more genes you get, the more likely you are to develop lupus. You can be born into a family where there's no one who has lupus and still get lupus because you might have gotten some of the genes from your mom and some of the genes from your father. In addition, though, it takes something in the environment to turn on the genes. You can be born with genes to cause lupus and never develop it throughout your lifetime. We think that it takes something from the environment. For example, ultraviolet light is the most well-known trigger to cause lupus. Someone can develop their first symptoms of lupus, for example, after going on a vacation to the beach and from all the sun exposure that they get. Viral infections are another common cause of autoimmune disorders. With lupus, we see it more commonly in people who have been infected with certain viruses, especially parvovirus and Epstein-Barr virus, which is the virus known to cause mononucleosis, are well-known triggers of systemic lupus. We don't really know all these factors as of yet as far as what triggers lupus to occur in people who are genetically predisposed, but there is a lot of research being done in this department at this time. Hormones definitely play a role, even though men and women can both inherit the genes that cause lupus. It's women who develop it much more often. In fact, 90% of our SLE patients are women, so hormones play a huge role in why some people who get these genes get lupus, while men are much less likely to get it. But still, 10% of our lupus patients are men and still can get the disease, but the hormones definitely play a large role. As far as how we diagnose SLE, there's no what we call diagnostic criteria, but there are what we call classification criteria, and these are in the handout. And what I mean by classification criteria is that these are criteria that are recommended that doctors use in order to help figure out what patients to put into research protocols to try to learn more about lupus and treat lupus. But I think that they're sufficiently helpful in diagnosing lupus as well. When I look at my SLE population in my clinic, the vast majority of my patients satisfy these criteria, and these are the newest ones that I included in the handout, which are proposed by Dr. Michelle Petrie up at Johns Hopkins and other lupus experts. We say that someone has SLE if they meet four of these 17 criteria. The first 11 are what we call clinical criteria, and the last six criteria, what we call immunologic or blood diagnosis criteria. The first 11, which are the clinical criteria, include the first one, which is acute or subacute cutaneous lupus. This does include the famous malar rash or butterfly rash, which is a red rash that occurs on the cheeks and bridge of the nose. It looks like the shape of a butterfly, and so that's why we all oftentimes call it the butterfly rash. The cheeks are also called the malar area in medical terms, so we oftentimes call it the malar rash. Also, the sun-sensitive rash, so going out into the sun and getting a pink coloration of the dorsal or the tops of the hands and tops of the forearms or the face, that's another type of rash that we see called acute cutaneous lupus. The second one is the discoid lupus. This is oftentimes occurs in the shape of disc or round-shaped or oval-shaped rash that it can oftentimes occur on the face and especially on the ears. And unfortunately, it can be very disfiguring if not treated rapidly. If anybody knows the singer Seal, he actually has this type of rash on his face. You might notice some discolorations of his face, and this is discoid lupus. Unfortunately, discoid lupus can also affect the hair and cause permanent scarring or hair loss in the scalp because of this. The third criteria is oral or nasal ulcers. These are open sores that can occur either on the septum of the inside of the nose, but also on the roof of the mouth. In fact, that's even more common. Often these are not painful at all, and you might not even know that you had these sores, but when your rheumatologist looks inside of your mouth, they'll often look at the top or the roof of your mouth to see if there's any sores that are present from systemic lupus that can help us figure out whether someone might have lupus or has a flare-up of their lupus. Non-scarring alopecia is hair loss. That's where there'll be thinning of the hair, especially at the front of the scalp. This can occur with when systemic lupus is more active and can help make the diagnosis of lupus. And it does come back with treatment, which is nice. It is a reversible type of hair loss. Fifth is inflammatory arthritis, which is inflammation of the joints, where there will be swelling and pain in the joints. Unlike rheumatoid arthritis, it's usually not deforming. In other words, our patients usually don't get joint destruction or irreversible joint damage, although that can occur in some patients. Sixth is inflammation around the lining of the lungs, heart, or abdomen. We call this serositis, which means inflammation of the serosa. Serosa is the lining of the lungs, heart, and abdomen, and basically allow these organs to glide smoothly inside of the body. For example, when you take in a deep breath, the lungs expand, and the way that they can expand without being uncomfortable is by this lubrication in the serosa. But when lupus attacks this lining of the lungs, when you take in a deep breath, the person will have inflammation occurring in that area, and it can almost be like sandpaper grinding against the chest wall, and they can have a lot of discomfort or pain when they try to take in a deep breath, and we call that pleurisy, or due to pleuritis when they get chest pain that occurs with deep breathing. But this can also occur with inflammation around the lining of the heart, which we call pericarditis, and even can occur around the lining of the abdomen, which we call peritonitis, and all of these can cause pain in the chest or pain in the abdomen due to this inflammation. Seventh is inflammation of the kidneys. About 40% of lupus patients will get lupus nephritis, which is inflammation of the kidneys, and we usually pick this up by finding protein in the urine. Eighth is inflammation of the nervous system, and there's a lot of different neurological problems that can occur in lupus. The old criteria only used seizures, which is also known as epilepsy, or psychosis, where the person might hallucinate or have difficulty thinking or be delirious, but there are other nerve problems that can occur as well. Hemolytic anemia is a very specific type of anemia where the lupus will attack the red blood cells and the red blood cell count will go down, which we call anemia. There's a lot of different types of anemia that can occur in lupus patients, but the only one we include for actual criteria is the hemolytic anemia. But most of our patients will actually get anemia due to iron deficiency simply from being young in women and menstruating and losing iron in their menstrual cycles every month, or due to inflammation or what we call anemia of chronic disease. A low white blood cell count can be used to help diagnose lupus. That's where lupus will attack the white blood cells and we'll see a low white blood cell count. Fortunately, this rarely causes any problems with actual infections or anything like that. A low platelet count can also occur and be used for diagnosing lupus. The platelets are very important for clotting in the body. So if someone has a really severe low platelet count, they can actually have problems with bruising and even bleeding problems if it becomes severely low. But most of the time, our patients don't have any symptoms whatsoever. We just find it on the blood test. As far as the immunologic criteria, a positive anti-nuclear antibody or ANA test needs to be seen in almost everybody. It's really rare to have systemic lupus these days and have a negative ANA, and it's usually this ANA test that's the very first thing that a doctor will find when working up someone who might have lupus that ends up sending them to the rheumatologist to be considered for this diagnosis in the first place. when we find someone who's positive for anti-nuclear antibody or ANA, the rheumatologist will usually do other confirmatory blood tests at that point. That does include the anti-double-stranded DNA, which is the second immunologic criteria. This particular blood test is pretty specific for lupus in that it's not commonly found in other diseases other than systemic lupus. Positive anti-Smith antibody is another very specific blood test for lupus. In fact, it's even much more specific than anti-DNA. I still have never seen a patient who has anti-Smith antibodies and does not have systemic lupus. It's that specific for lupus. Number four is antiphospholipid antibodies. There's a bunch of different antibodies to include: lupus anticoagulant, false positive syphilis test, anti-cardiolipin antibody, and even a very long one called anti-beta-2 glycoprotein 1 antibody. The important things of these antibodies is that they occur in about 30% of our lupus patients, and over time, about 50% of those patients can potentially get blood clots related to these antibodies. So we oftentimes ask our patients to take low-dose baby aspirin every day to prevent blood clots. And if they do cause blood clots, we'll have to treat the patient with blood thinners. The fifth immunologic criteria are low complement levels, especially C3, C4, and CH50. So we can check these on blood tests. And then lastly, being positive for a particular antibody called Coombs antibody. So to summarize this, the bottom line is that before we make a diagnosis of SLE, we like to see four out of these 17 total criteria before we make that diagnosis. However, there is one exception, and that's patients who have lupus nephritis. There are some patients who will develop inflammation of the kidneys and will get a kidney biopsy to figure that out, where we'll get a piece of the kidney and look at it under the microscope. And even if they have nothing else going on but lupus nephritis by the kidney biopsy, we feel confident in making that diagnosis, even if they don't have meet 4 out of the 11 criteria. So how is SLE treated? I think firstly it's important to go over the non-medical treatments. There are certain things that should be done by all lupus patients to treat their lupus that do not involve medications. And the first most important thing is protecting yourself from ultraviolet light. The reason for that is that that ultraviolet light, when it contacts the skin, it damages the cells right underneath the skin, and these cells release their proteins and antigens, which are proteins that the immune system attacks. And in the lupus patient, when the lupus patient's immune system sees these damaged cells or the proteins from the cells, it actually causes the immune system to become more active, and then the immune system attacks the body itself, even the kidneys and the liver and the skin. And this ultraviolet light comes from not just the sun, but also indoor lighting. And so fluorescent lights or incandescent lights inside, you need to protect yourself from this ultraviolet light by using sunscreen every single day, even if you don't go outside. So we do ask our patients to wear sunscreen every day, even if they don't go outside. But the difference is that if you go outside, you want to wear your sunscreen 2 to 3 times a day. Try to wear the highest SPF possible. The higher the SPF or sun protection factor, the more oily or thick the lotion is. So some people don't tolerate the really high ones like 150 or 100 SPF, but try to wear the highest one that you can tolerate every day. Also make sure that your sunscreen blocks against ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B rays as well. And also make sure that it's waterproof because it usually lasts longer. Another way to protect yourself from ultraviolet light is to wear clothing that has increased SPF protection. When you wear clothing, most clothes only have an SPF protection of about 15 or anywhere from 5 to 15. But if you get extra sun protection with your clothing, there's actually clothing wear out there that have extra SPF protection that can be very helpful. If you have regular clothes, you can purchase Ritz Sun Guard, and this is a powder that you add to your clothing and you wash your clothes in. And if you do that, the SPF actually increases to around 30, and it lasts for about 4 to 15 cycles of washing your clothes afterwards. So if you use Ritz Sun Guard about 3 to 4 times with your clothing, then it can actually increase your sun protection with your clothes, and it's pretty inexpensive to do that. Also, it's important to avoid sun between 10 in the morning and 5 p.m., and also wearing a wide-brimmed hat when you go outside in the sun can be very helpful as well. There are other things that can actually trigger lupus to be active, and it's important to learn to avoid those things. Number one are sulfa antibiotics, especially with urinary tract infections, which is very common in women. These are the most common antibiotics that doctors use to treat urinary tract infections, and this includes the antibiotic Septra and Bactrim, and goes by the generic name trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. And so it's very important that all systemic lupus patients list these antibiotics as an allergy, even if they've never taken the antibiotic before. Every single year I have at least one or two patients who end up in the emergency room with a severe lupus flare because a doctor gave them one of these antibiotics and they didn't realize that they should not take them. But we have a lot of other antibiotics that are much safer to use in our lupus patients. There's an herbal supplement called Echinacea that we also recommend that patients not take. This is an herbal product that's promoted to treat colds, but the problem is that Echinacea increases the immune system, and that's just the opposite of what we want to occur in our lupus patients. Remember, lupus is a disease where the immune system is already overactive, and we don't want to make it more active because that's a bad thing with systemic lupus. The Johns Hopkins Hospital Lupus Center, they've actually seen a few of their patients get really severe lupus flares simply by taking Echinacea, so please never take that. Alfalfa and mung bean sprouts should also be avoided. These actually contain an amino acid called L-cannabinine, which can also actually cause lupus flares, so avoid those in your salads and foods and eating in your diet. It also can be helpful. It's very important that all lupus patients take some sort of medicine to calm down the immune system. These days, almost all lupus experts agree that all lupus patients should take some type of medication called an anti-malarial medicine, and Plaquenil, which is also called hydroxychloroquine, is the most common, and we'll go into detail about why we recommend anti-malarial medicines. The second group of medicines is called steroids. This includes prednisone and Medrol. These are the fastest-working medicines for lupus and can be life-saving in lupus patients, and we'll talk about those in more detail. And then lastly, we'll talk about the medicines that actually suppress the immune system or the immunosuppressant medications. So first we'll talk about the anti-malarial medicines. Malaria, as many people know, is a severe, potentially deadly type of infection that occurs in the tropics. And we don't use these medicines to treat malaria in lupus patients, but it was found out by accident that anti-malarial medicines help lupus. And this goes back to World War II when our sailors were in the Pacific fighting in World War II. It was observed by some British physicians that the sailors who had skin involvement from lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, that they actually got better when they took their anti-malarial medicines to prevent malaria from happening. And that's how we kind of stumbled upon these medicines as being beneficial in our lupus patients. These days, the most common anti-malarial medicine that we use is called Plaquenil. Plaquenil is also called hydroxychloroquine, but there are two other medications that we also use. One is called Arilin and one is called Atibrine. Every single lupus patient should be on one of these medicines to treat their lupus, and I'll go over the reasons why that's so. First of all, these medicines are very good for treating the arthritis of lupus, and about 90% of lupus patients do get joint pains of some sort. Many of our lupus patients have low blood counts, and these medicines can increase the blood count levels. They're also very good for the rashes of lupus. Fatigue is very common in lupus, and these particular medicines can help to improve the energy level in our patients with lupus. And then they also can be very helpful for mild pleurisy. But four very important reasons why lupus experts recommend that all of our patients take antimalarials is, number one, they decrease the need for prednisone. The studies clearly show that patients with systemic lupus who take antimalarials regularly, such as Plaquenil, they actually require less steroids over time, such as prednisone, compared to those who do not take antimalarial medicines. Number two, there's a decreased risk for developing severe organ damage. Lupus patients who take Plaquenil regularly are much less likely to get severe kidney involvement, lung involvement, heart and brain involvement compared to those who do not take antimalarials like Plaquenil. Number three, they decrease the risk for blood clots. In fact, when these were first being used back in the 1950s, there were actually a lot of studies being done by surgeons back then looking at their usage in preventing blood clots after surgery. These days, we know that patients who take these, especially the ones who have antiphospholipid antibodies, which can cause blood clots, that they decrease the risk of getting blood clots by thinning out the blood. And then lastly, there's a decreased risk of death. There's actually been a few very large studies, especially one that was done in Canada about a decade ago, which looked at a large group of lupus patients and found that those who took Plaquenil regularly were much less likely to die from their lupus compared to those who were not taking Plaquenil. And Plaquenil is so much safer than all the other medicines that we use to treat lupus that it's much better to take the Plaquenil to help decrease the need for taking the stronger medicines. So Plaquenil is hydroxychloroquine. It is the most common medicine that we use to treat SLE, and it is felt by lupus experts that all SLE patients should be taking Plaquenil unless you truly have an allergy to the Plaquenil. And the one reason for this is that it's very rare to have any major side effects to the Plaquenil. As far as side effects, about 10% of patients can get either rash, headaches, dizziness, difficulty sleeping, or stomach upset, but we consider these mild side effects. And what I mean by that is that even though these side effects can occur with the medicine, if we stop the medicine, these side effects go away, and then they usually we can usually find a lower dose of the medicine that the person can tolerate without developing these particular side effects. And so these are reversible mild side effects that go away with a lower dosage. As far as the eyes and Plaquenil and chloroquine, it is very important that patients realize that they do have to see an ophthalmologist or eye doctor regularly while they take either Plaquenil and chloroquine. But please don't let this potential side effect prevent you from taking these medications. The vast majority of patients who take Plaquenil will never develop a problem with the eye. What can happen with the eye and Plaquenil is that, and I'll go back to the 1960s and 1950s when these medicines were first used, they used much higher doses of Plaquenil than we use today. And what would happen is that the medicine could deposit in the back of the eye and cause some problems with blurred vision. But these days, we use much lower doses of Plaquenil than they used to use in the old days, and it's really rare for someone to get a problem with the eyes from Plaquenil with the currently used doses. In fact, the eye doctor or ophthalmologist would see problems way before the person would ever notice any visual problems. And in fact, in my experience, most rheumatologists and eye doctors have never even seen a case of Plaquenil problems with the eyes. That's how rare it is. But we still recommend that our patients see an eye doctor about once a year. It is much more common with the antimalarial medicine called chloroquine, however, and so that's why we don't use chloroquine nearly as often, because it can affect about 10% of users over time when they take it. And so we do ask our patients to see their ophthalmologist about every 3 months if they take the medicine called chloroquine. And by the way, if you want to take an extra precaution as far as preventing any eye problems from Plaquenil or chloroquine, a very easy thing to do is to get something called an Amsler grid. An Amsler grid, you can either get one from your ophthalmologist, which is the eye doctor, or you can easily download one over the internet. just go to google.com, and if you type in Amsler grid, it's very easy to find them online. It's just a simple grid that you can look at. You look at the dot on the middle of the grid using one eye at a time, and you should easily see all four corners and all lines of the grid. If any of them look wavy or you don't see any of them normally, then you should see your ophthalmologist. And this is a very good way to pick up early problems with the eyes. And by the way, if you do have a problem looking at the Amsler grid or not seeing it correctly, it's much more common for it to be due to some other type of eye problem other than your Plaquenil or chloroquine. For example, diabetes affecting the eyes, high blood pressure affecting the retina of the eyes, or even something called macular degeneration are much more common causes of an abnormality on this Amsler grid. But it's also nice insurance. If you look at this every month and you never see a problem with the Amsler grid, then you can be rest assured that you're unlikely to have any problems from your Plaquenil medication. Special word about smoking and lupus. Lupus patients should never smoke cigarettes, and there's several different reasons why this is so. Number one, smoking cigarettes actually decreases how well Plaquenil works. So here we have Plaquenil, which is by far the safest medicine to use in lupus. But if you take cigarette or you smoke cigarettes, it decreases the effectiveness of Plaquenil even working in the first place. In addition, tobacco contains a chemical called hydrazine, and hydrazine actually causes the immune system of lupus to be more active, and lupus becomes more active, and we see more lupus flares because of tobacco. Number three, patients with systemic lupus are at higher risk of developing heart attacks and strokes. In fact, our lupus patients get heart attacks and strokes about 10 years younger than their peers. In African American women, it's even worse. African American women develop heart attacks and strokes about 20 years younger than their peers. And cigarette smoking definitely is a huge risk factor in developing heart attacks and strokes. So it's very important not to smoke. And then fourthly, cancer. Our lupus patients, by the way, don't get cancer nearly as often as heart attacks and strokes, but it is the fourth most common cause of death in lupus patients, especially lung cancer. And, of course, cigarette smoking is a leading cause of lung cancer, so it's important not to smoke for that reason. Next, we'll talk about steroids. Steroids are naturally occurring hormones, and the most common ones that we use to treat our lupus patients are prednisone and Medrol, which is also called methylprednisolone. The reason we use steroids is that steroids decrease inflammation very quickly. There's nothing that works as quick as steroids in suppressing the immune system to treat our lupus patients. It is important to realize that our own bodies make steroids every day. My body makes about 5 to 7 milligrams of prednisone a day. So when your rheumatologist gets you down to around 5 to 7 milligrams a day, they consider that to be a much safer dose, or what we call a physiologic dose of steroids at that point. However, in lupus, steroids are life-saving medications. Before steroids came around in 1949, most patients with lupus died within the first couple of years of the disease, and is even much, much worse in children who the vast majority were dead within the first year of diagnosis of lupus. But once steroids came around, that changed completely. Most patients started to live actually after the first 5 years when steroids came around, is even those who had severe disease. And these days, it's definitely still a life-saving medication. However, prednisone is a double-edged sword in that almost all patients who take prednisone will get side effects if they take it long enough and if they take it at high enough doses. It's much less likely to happen at the physiologic doses of less than 7 milligrams, but anything over 7 milligrams a day will cause side effects in almost everyone. We consider 20 milligrams a day or more to be high doses, and that's when people are especially at high risk of developing infections. The side effects of prednisone occur less if you take it first thing in the morning, so we do recommend taking prednisone as soon as you wake up in the morning. Other side effects of prednisone include increased appetite, weight gain occurs, people have heard about steroids being taken by bodybuilders to build up their muscles. Well, those are a different type of steroids called anabolic steroids. Everything that anabolic steroids do in athletes, prednisone does just the opposite. We call it a catabolic steroid. This includes weight gain, but it's because it breaks down muscle and turns that muscle into fat. So unfortunately, our patients will gain weight from fat, and their muscle mass actually becomes smaller. They also develop fluid retention by the kidneys holding onto sodium, and then the sodium holds onto salt and water, and so our patients can get bloating and even swelling of the ankles or feet because of the fluid retention. They can also develop something called moon face, where the face will actually become a moon or round-shaped, and they'll also develop something called buffalo hump, where they'll get some fat deposition on the top of the back from the fat accumulation. Skin thinning and bruising can occur. Increased hair growth can occur, but at parts of the body you don't want it, like on the face. And, of course, in women, you don't want that to occur. Hypertension or high blood pressure can occur. It may increase the risk of heart disease because of the increased high blood pressure, but also diabetes or high glucose levels and sugar levels can occur as well. Steroids can actually decrease the effectiveness of how our cells in our bones make hard bones. So osteoporosis can occur, where the bones can become fragile and break. Cataracts and glaucoma can occur in the eyes. Our patients can become moody with depression and anxiety occurring. Infections can occur at the high doses of steroid use. There's something called adrenal insufficiency that all steroid users should know about. The adrenal gland is a very small gland that sits on top of the kidneys, and it's constantly making prednisone every single day. And because the prednisone is essential for us to live normally and to have a normal blood pressure. But once you've been on prednisone for a long time, the adrenal gland basically shuts down, becomes smaller, and it can't make those essential steroids anymore. In fact, the adrenal gland is very essential for making more steroids. Like if we get an infection or if we undergo surgery or have any type of stress, the adrenal gland actually is required to make high doses of steroids, as much as 20 milligrams a day, just to get us through the stress of the surgery or the infection or the trauma. And so if you've been on steroids for any amount of time, your doctor may want to give you extra prednisone or steroids around the time of surgery, infections, or trauma. In fact, patients who are on prednisone or steroids for a long time should consider wearing a medical alert bracelet so that medical personnel can know to give them extra steroids if they end up in the emergency room due to any type of illness or infection, or even if they had to get emergency surgery. So some tips on avoiding the side effects of steroids. Number one, never miss a daily dose. And that's most important because if you do develop adrenal insufficiency, it can be very dangerous to miss your daily dose of steroids. Also, take it first thing in the morning. You're actually less apt to get the adrenal insufficiency if you take it first thing in the morning when you first wake up. However, if you miss your morning dose, it's still important to take it as soon as you remember it later in that day. It's more important to remember your dose of the prednisone rather than missing it if you forget it first thing in the morning. Also, it's important that steroids be tapered slowly. The reason for this is that we have to teach the adrenal gland to start making prednisone again. Please never taper down the steroids on your own. Always do it in conjunction with what your doctor recommends. If you stop the prednisone abruptly on your own, that could be very dangerous. In fact, patients have been known to go into a coma or drop their blood pressure because of stopping the prednisone too quickly. So never do that on your own. Wear the medical alert bracelet if you're on it for a long time. As far as preventing weight gain, it's very important to try to prevent the weight gain in the first place. So if you go on steroids, please exercise regularly by strengthening up your muscles. Try to keep that muscle mass as much as you can by doing some type of weight training about three days a week, and then do aerobic exercise 4 to 5 days a week to help burn up the calories to prevent the weight gain. Strict diet is also very important. Prednisone, unfortunately, makes almost everyone very hungry. It will make those carbohydrates and cakes and cookies and donuts look like you'll feel like you're an addict because you want to eat those carbohydrates. But it's very important to try to fight against that by trying to decrease the amount of calories in your diet, fat, cholesterol, and sodium to try to prevent that weight gain. It's essential to prevent osteoporosis. You need at least 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day. In fact, you need more calcium than other women. So what you read about the requirements of calcium in normal women, you need actually more than that. And the reason for that is that prednisone actually decreases the absorption of calcium from the intestinal system. So you need a minimum of 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams a day. And in this handout, I just listed just a few foods with their calcium amounts, but you can also find more information on the internet. If you can't take in enough calcium in your diet, then consider taking extra calcium supplements to get enough calcium in your diet. Another very important thing is that a lot of lupus patients take medicines to lower the acidity of their stomach, medicines like Zantac and Prilosec, Protonix, Nexium. If you take any of those medicines, you're not going to absorb calcium from your diet properly, and even OsCal and Caltrate and calcium carbonate supplements are not absorbed. The reason for that is that calcium carbonate and calcium phosphate, which are the calciums found in those supplements and in food, require acidity in the stomach to get absorbed. But if you're taking acid-lowering medicines, you're not going to absorb that calcium. And so it's very important to take calcium citrate instead. Calcium citrate does not require acid in the stomach. So if you take an acid-lowering medicine, you should be taking Citracal or some other type of calcium citrate and just follow the directions on the bottle. Vitamin D is very important. You need vitamin D in order to absorb calcium properly, so make sure you get drinking vitamin D fortified milk or taking a vitamin D supplement every day. And by the way, the vast majority of lupus patients are deficient in vitamin D. Make sure that your doctor has checked your vitamin D level and gets it up with a vitamin D supplement. There's a couple of reasons why patients are deficient in vitamin D. Number one, a large percentage of our patients are dark-skinned, like African-Americans, Latinos, and the melanin or dark pigmentation prevents ultraviolet light from going through the skin to make vitamin D. And by the way, that's how we normally get vitamin D, is through regular sun exposure, because our skin produces vitamin D through the by way of the sun exposure. The other reason is that we're asking our patients to stay out of the sun and use sunscreen, and so we're getting rid of that natural way that we make vitamin D as well. So most of our patients do need to be on a vitamin D supplement of some sort. Weight-bearing exercise is very important to keep the bones strong. In fact, that's how our bones learn to stay strong. So doing some sort of weight-bearing exercise, such as weight training, aerobics, treadmill, walking for 30 minutes, 5 days a week, is very important. If you're on prednisone for more than 5 milligrams a day for more than a few weeks, and definitely if this you're on it for more than a few months, most doctors will recommend that you take a medication to keep your bones strong, medicines such as Fosamax, Actonel, Reclast, or Boniva. If your doctor plans on tapering you off the prednisone, he may not put you on those medicines, but if it looks like you're going to be on the prednisone for a long time, it's best to take a medicine to keep your bones strong. And then we also recommend getting a bone density x-ray on a yearly basis, which is a good way to monitor the bone strength and make sure you don't develop osteoporosis. Next, we'll talk about the immunosuppressant medicines. Some patients do need to be on medicines that suppress the immune system. This does include prednisone in high doses, methotrexate, Areva, Imuran, Cytoxan, and Cellcept. Infection, by the way, is one of the most common causes of death in lupus patients. It's the second or third most common cause of death. And so it's very important, if you ever get any infection symptoms, to call and see your primary care doctor right away for appropriate evaluation and antibiotic treatment. Also, the immunosuppressant medicines can lower the blood counts, so we do recommend getting a blood count done every 4 to 8 weeks on these medicines, and then we also monitor the liver function test to make sure that they don't irritate the liver as well. If important things to remember while you take immunosuppressants is that you want to call your doctor if you develop any infection symptoms whatsoever. Also, during infections, you want to make sure that you stop the medicine, except for prednisone. You never want to stop prednisone abruptly. If you're going to get surgery done, it's very important to stop the medicine before you undergo surgery. You need to ask your rheumatologist specifics on that. And again, don't stop the prednisone. You actually usually need more prednisone or steroids around the time of the surgery. As far as taking medicines in lupus, unfortunately, the medication treatment of lupus can be very complex. Some helpful hints is keep a list of medicines with you all the time. I ask my patients to bring in a list of their medications with them at every visit. It can get so complicated that it's not uncommon for the doctor to think the patient is taking their medicines one way, but then the patient is taking them differently. So keep an active list of all medicines, what their doses is, how you're taking them, and I recommend keeping it on the computer, and every time a doctor makes a change, make a change on your computer and then print it out and take it in every time you see any of your doctors to make sure that everybody's on the same page. Always go to the same pharmacy as well, because that way the pharmacy can make sure there's no drug interactions. As far as life expectancy in lupus, things are very different today than they were in the past. Before steroids, 83% of patients died within the first 2 years of diagnosis. But today, the vast majority of our patients live long, normal lives, which is wonderful news. Unfortunately, there are some patients who can still get severe lupus and can, unfortunately, die earlier from the disease. But patients who take their medications and are treated aggressively by their doctors who are specialized in treating lupus, the vast majority do live a long, normal life, which is good. As far as living a long, normal life, if you know what bad things can happen in lupus, that can help arm yourself to live a long, normal life. In addition to learning how to treat your lupus, severe infections and cardiovascular disease from heart attacks and strokes are the other most common causes of death in our lupus patients. So learning how to prevent those from happening can go a long way in staying alive for a long, normal time. As far as preventing infections, one of the most important things is to do all those things I already talked about that decrease your need for taking the strong medicines. So taking the Plaquenil religiously every day, using your sunscreen religiously every day, wearing the sun protective clothing every day, not smoking cigarettes, which, you know, prevents the Plaquenil from working in the first place. All those are very important for preventing infections. Getting vaccinations is extremely important. So getting a pneumonia vaccine a couple times in your life, getting the flu shot every fall is really important. If you're over the age of 50, you should get a Zostavax to prevent shingles infection. And then I listed the other recommendations for preventing infections also on the handout as well. As far as treating infections, if you ever get a fever or any type of infection symptoms at all, such as shaking, chills, coughing up sputum, you need to call and see your primary care physician right away. The wrong thing to do is to stay at home and hope that you get better on your own. You really want to see your doctor and get it taken care of. As far as avoiding heart attacks and strokes, remember, our patients do get heart attacks and strokes about 10 to 20 years younger than their counterparts. So living an active lifestyle with exercising regularly, eating properly, not smoking cigarettes is really important. We ask that all of our patients see a primary care doctor on a regular basis to make sure their cholesterol and blood pressure are kept under control and that any problems with diabetes are addressed and treated early. Avoiding cancer is extremely important, but fortunately it's not a common cause of death in our lupus patients, but making sure that you get your cancer screenings with colonoscopies, mammograms, pap smears are very important. And if you're young, 26 years of age or less and not in a monogamous sexual relationship, it's also recommended that you get the Gardasil vaccination against human papillomavirus vaccine. The reason for that is that many of the cancers that can be caused by HPV or human papillomavirus, for some reason they're more common in our lupus patients, and getting the Gardasil vaccination can prevent those from happening. And so that's my main recommendations in how to live a long, normal life with systemic lupus erythematosus. It's a disorder which I feel strongly in treating, and because most of my patients do very well with proper treatment, and it's something you can do a lot for yourself as well. So I hope that I've been able to give some practical information to people listening on in on this talk in living with your lupus, and hopefully I'll be able to answer some of your questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was always informative and very helpful. And I would like to remind people that if their question doesn't get answered tonight, that they can contact their chapter, and the chapter will be more than glad to help them find answers and resources. Also, you did ask, Dr. Thomas, that we give you a critique on both the handout and the presentation, anything that you that the people listening feel would make it better, and we certainly encourage them to reach out to their chapters, and we will collect that information for you. So we have some questions. I would like to find out what the doctor suggests for newly diagnosed patients who may already be dealing with another illness. What types of mental health matters can a newly diagnosed person expect? Is it normal when you are newly diagnosed to feel confused and out of touch with reality? I have crying spells. I'm paranoid about the least little thing. I have another life-altering or life-changing illness, and now I'm dealing with this.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear that. First of all, lupus itself can cause central nervous system problems. In fact, as I mentioned, psychosis, hallucinations, delusions can actually be caused by the lupus itself. But also, our patients get anxiety disorder and depression more often than other people. And there's a lot of stuff to sort through. I think that anyone in this particular type of situation absolutely should have a good psychiatrist to help figure these matters out. For example, someone with just severe depression can have all the symptoms that were just mentioned and not require stronger therapy for their lupus. While if someone's having active inflammation of the brain from their lupus, they may require strong immunosuppressant medications. So this is a situation where you definitely want a good psychiatrist who's comfortable with treating lupus, but also a rheumatologist who's an expert in lupus dealing with it as well. And I'll just say up front, this is not an easy situation at all. There's a lot of issues to be figured out, and unfortunately not something that I can give a whole lot of advice other than making sure that you have a very good psychiatrist and rheumatologist working together to sort through these issues. And I wish you all the best. That's a tough situation.
Yeah. The next question, I was diagnosed with SLE and discoid lupus in 1997. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I've had several strokes. I want to get some exercise into my daily routine, but do you have any suggestions on how I can get started, what I could start doing so that I could get more exercise?
This is a situation where I would absolutely want to use a good physical therapist, because if you've had strokes, you may be left with some functional difficulties like weakness or numbness in areas that might make it difficult to just jump into exercise on your own. A good exercise regimen should consist of a combination of muscle strengthening, aerobic exercise, and stretching. And so this is where I would want to get the expertise of a physical therapist, because they're really the experts when it comes to the body and exercise. And what I would do if you were my patient is I would write a referral to the physical therapist. I would list what has happened to you physical-wise and ask them to design an exercise regimen to help out. And it's really good you're asking this question, because it's so hard to get my patients to exercise. So I think you're taking a wonderful step by asking this question in the first place. But check with your doctor and ask them to write you a referral to a good physical therapist.
Great. Over a period of years, I sometimes have blood tests for lupus and Sjogren's that are positive, sometimes both are negative. How is this possible? What is the significance?
That's a great question. First of all, With proper treatment, 20% of our lupus patients will actually become anti-nuclear antibody negative over time, 20%. And so it's a very important thing that I recommend all my patients do, or all patients, is make sure you get copies of those first labs and progress notes and consultation notes from your rheumatologist that made the diagnosis. Because if you move somewhere else, 20% of the time your labs are going to come back negative and the rheumatologist is not going to think you have lupus at all, and you could get all your medicines stopped and you could have a severe flare. So that's the bottom line, is that these antibodies can all go negative with proper treatment. So it's what those initial labs show that are really extremely important, and I would urge you to get copies of your medical records and keep them with you permanently.
Okay. Is it possible for lupus and autoantibodies to attack the heart valves? The valves are made of connective tissue, and isn't connective tissue one of the targets?
Absolutely. There's a disorder called Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis. Endocarditis means inflammation of the inside of the heart, specifically the heart valves. This is primarily seen in patients who have antiphospholipid antibodies. So patients who are, and those are listed on the handout, anticardiolipin antibodies, false positive syphilis tests, and the lupus anticoagulant. Patients who are high positive for those can actually get inflammation of the heart valves and blood clots on the heart valves and get this. We rarely see it today because most rheumatologists identify these antibodies early, and we think that by using Plaquenil and aspirin, we're able to prevent the really bad problems we used to see 20 years ago. So it's really rare today, but our patients do get valve problems more often in other people, and it's most likely related to the antiphospholipid antibodies.
And then we have a question on lighting, and I know this is one that's on the minds of many lupus patients. I'm hugely photosensitive, and can both fluorescent and halogen lights make me sick? Because there are covers for fluorescent, but I'm not aware of anything I can do for halogens or CFLs.
And you're exactly right. Unfortunately, ultraviolet light does come from indoor lighting as well. And it's the fluorescent lights, which are higher in ultraviolet light than the incandescent. And the differences between those is that the older lights, which are the bulbs that we normally think of, those are the incandescent lights. Those are actually lower in ultraviolet light. But now with our wanting to be green and save on energy, the fluorescent lights, which are the ones that are kind of twirly in shape, that are becoming very popular right now, those are actually higher in ultraviolet light, so they're better for the environment, but unfortunately they're worse for the lupus patient. And so it is very important to learn how to get coverings for your lights that can decrease the amount of ultraviolet light emitted, and they are available in order to do that. But it's another very good reason why all lupus patients should be wearing sunscreen religiously every day, even if they do not go outside.
Okay. And I think that's about it. As I say, if people have other questions, they can certainly follow up with their chapters. They'll be ready and expect questions tomorrow. And if they have any suggestions for the presentation, please get in touch with your chapter and they'll forward them to us. So thank you very much for giving us your time this evening. It's been informative and very helpful.
Okay. Thank you, Penny, and good luck to everyone.
Thank you. Good night.